is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
It's Tuesday, May 21st, and this is the Baseball Tonight podcast. I'm Buster Olney. Our producer every day is Josh Macri. Josh, I think it's established now that you and I are the only two humans on the planet who really didn't get into Game of Thrones at all, right? I think we talked about that before.
Yeah, I certainly didn't get into it. I know you didn't get into it. I think we're one of maybe five or six. Something tells me Tim hasn't gotten into it. Tim probably doesn't even know that it exists. It's a pretty exclusive club, Buster.
And you always hear about, you know, book widows, right? Or show widows or widowers. You know, the show comes to an end, you're looking for something to go to. I highly recommend for all of you that did love Game of Thrones, just start following the Mets, right? Okay.
No spoilers, though, Buster. No spoilers, please. Yeah,
it's a new episode every day. You don't know where it's going, and that's what happened on Monday as we get into our news and notes of the day. Brody Van Wagenen, the general manager of the Mets, came out, of course, at a time when there's so much speculation about Mickey Callaway and would he be retained as manager. Well, there was a plot twist. Brody Van Wagenen announced that Yoenis Cespedes got hurt on his ranch.
On Saturday night, we received news from him that he suffered an accident on his ranch in Port St. Lucie and suffered ankle fractures. So he is here in New York. He's at HSS. He's being evaluated, and we'll have more information on his prognosis and what his future is, hopefully in the coming days. But right now, that's the story from his standpoint, and what the information is that we have at this point in time. So our focus currently is to try to get him the best medical care, and then hopefully get a better idea of what this means for his future, both in 2019 and beyond.
So, Josh, did you hear the interesting phrase right in there? That's his story.
That's his story. Wonder if you can read anything into that, Buster.
There could be some more plot twists coming up. And, of course, Mike Puma does a great job covering the Mets for the New York Post, tweeted out a little bit later that the Mets are looking into the language of Cespedes' contract to determine whether or not they might have some relief and salary. Was it a violation of the contract? And the Mets should know this better than anyone, Josh, because, of course, the person who negotiated the contract was Brody Van Wagenen.
Huh. You don't say.
Cespedes is agent. Look, you just can't make it up. Brody said Mickey Callaway is the manager for the foreseeable future. And we'll be talking about that coming up with Tyler Kepner, who covers baseball for the New York Times. And that's Mets played the Nationals last night. It was a little tense. There's stuff going on in that game. Adam Eaton, Todd Frazier got into a war of words. But in the end, the Mets prevailed.
The first pitch. Zip lines up the middle of base hit. Carlos Gomez scores from third. Dominic Smith breaks out of a 1-for-15, swinging at the first pitch and slamming a base hit to center.
That didn't take long. Tony Zip delivered. So did Dom Smith.
That was from WCBS. The Padres played the Diamondbacks, and Franmil Reyes got a big hit for the Padres in the bottom of the sixth.
Swings at the first pitch and sends it in the air to deep right center field. Dyson racing back, looking up, it's gonna go! A two-run homer for Franmil Reyes, and he does change the game with one big swing. Padres lead 2-1, just like that.
You just aren't going to continue to get Franmil Reyes out the same way.
That from 97.3, the Fan. The Padres win 2-1. Chris Paddock was outstanding again. Six strong innings. The Braves and the Giants. Ronald Acuna Jr. had himself a day.
High fly, deep to center. Did he get another one? Duggar all the way back at the wall, climbs it. It's out of here. Ronald Acuna is putting on a show. It is a two-out solo home run to center field. His 11th, his second tonight, his third extra base hit. And it's 4-1 Braves.
Jim Powell on 680 The Fan. By the way, we've got the Braves and Ronald Acuna Jr. leading off against the St. Louis Cardinals this weekend on Sunday Night Baseball. The Twins played the Angels. Miguel Sano got a big hit in the top of the eighth.
Well, if Miguel's going to get a pitch to hammer, this may be it. A 2-0 count as Rosario stays, and here it comes. He swings and launches high and deep to right center field. Back it goes, deep it goes, and gone! Miguel Sano, a go-ahead two-run homer. You can't miss against this guy, Danny, sitting 2-0, and he did not.
Of Corey Provis, Treasure Island Baseball Network. It was a tough night for the Angels as they lose 3-1 in the bottom of the eighth inning. They lost in consecutive at-bats Shohei Ohtani and Andrelton Simmons to injuries. It doesn't necessarily look like the Ohtani injury is serious, but yes, with the Simmons injury. We'll be talking about that coming up with Tim Kirkchin. The Rangers beat the Mariners 10-9, but along the way, Mike Minor set a record.
2-2 pitch, hit in the air. Short center field, Gallo in and to his left. He's got it. 5 shutout innings in the books tonight for Mike Minor. And that's a 1-2-3 inning. After 4.5, it's 7-0 Texas.
That from Eric Nedell, 105.3. The Fan, 29 consecutive scoreless innings at that point for Mike Minor. The Phillies played the Cubs in Wrigley Field. Jake Arrieta came to the plate. He got a really nice ovation. The two teams would play into extra innings. Top of the 10th inning, JT Realmuto.
Realmuto waiting on a 1-2 pitch. Here it comes. Swung on. Hit well. Left field and deep. Going back is Schwarber to the track. At the wall. It's gone. JT Realmuto has given the Phillies the lead here in the top of the 10th inning. A solo home run is 6th of the year. Phillies back on top. 5-4.
Scott Fransky, Sports Radio 94 WIP. Now, it's about this time of year, it seems like every year, that Oakland begins to gather momentum. Maybe that's starting to happen. Here's what Matt Chapman did on Monday night.
Simeon at first base with one out, and a changeup is drilled deep left. Back on it as Bowers looks up, and it's gone! It clears the 19-foot-high wall, it goes up the runway, and out into the crowd. A key home run for Matt Chapman. It's number 11 as he burns Clippard and he scores Simeon. And the A's have extended their lead now to 6-3.
8:60 a.m. The answer. Oakland wins 6-4. Yeah, the turnaround seemingly has started. The Red Sox and the Blue Jays playing a 1 o'clock game on a national holiday in Toronto. Blue Jays fans really unhappy that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was not in the lineup. We'll be talking with Tim about that as well. For Jackie Bradley Jr., a moment of damage.
Now the set pitch on the way. Swung on, lifted in the air toward left field. Hit pretty good. Going back to the track, going to the wall. He looks up, and that ball is gone. It's out of here. Bradley goes the other way. An opposite field home run to make it 8-2 Red Sox.
And they would win 12-2. That sound from WEEI.
Deep center field. The game.
It's gone.
Of the day.
Game of the day was in Baltimore, which is known by to Yankee fans as Yankee Stadium South, because so many Yankee fans go down to Baltimore to watch the Yankees usually beat up on the Orioles. In this game, on Monday night, the Orioles actually held a 6-1 lead. This is part of how they built the lead.
And the pitch swinging a high fly ball center field that chases Hicks back. On the warning track at the wall, he leaps and it's gone! It's out of here for a home run! Hanser Alberto to the sod farm, and the Orioles' lead is now 3-1.
That was Jim Hunter, 105.7, the Fan. But then the Yankees would come back.
Torres 1-for-3. Swings at the first pitch. It's a high fly ball. Deep left center field. Smith leaps. He can't get it. This one is gone. A home run for Gleyber Torres, and it's now a 7-6 ball game.
Gleyber Torres with his 8th homer of the year against the Baltimore Orioles, as described by Ken Singleton on the YES Network. The Yankees were batting in the 9th inning, still trying to come back, and this is what happened.
Here's a 3-2 pitch, and it's popped up. Severino behind home plate, tosses away the mask, and the ball falls. He doesn't make the play. The at-bat will continue.
The at-bat continued. The inning continued. This is what happened.
Swung on, drilled to deep right. It is high. It is far. It is gone. It's a 3-run home run for the Santino. A 2-out, 9th inning, 3-run blast. Oh, that Gary is scary.
It just doesn't seem right, Josh. When the Orioles play the Yankees these days, it just seems like a cat and a mouse, right? Where the mouse is wounded and lying there and then tries to crawl away and the cat is like, nope, sorry, you're not going anywhere.
I thought you were trying to make fun of John Sterling's call there. I was going to say Gary is scary is probably his best call, to be honest with you. But no, you went in a different direction. That's okay.
Yeah, well, I went in the direction of how dominant the Yankees have been, despite all their injuries, as you say, John Sterling on WFAN. One other note, Dodgers pitcher Julio Urias is to be reinstated as Major League Baseball continues to look into the incident that he was involved in recently. He was on leave for 7 days. The most Mets day ever. Let's get to it. Tyler Kepner covers baseball for the New York Times. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. Before we get to the Mets and all the Mets stuff, Tyler, how's the book tour stuff going?
It's been fun, Buster. Thanks. Yeah, the book's doing really well, and you know what it's like. I mean, you put so much time, put so much of yourself into it. You just want it to come out right, and you want people to appreciate it the way that you wanted it to be viewed, you know, and that's happened so far. So it's good. Thanks for asking. And yeah, Father's Day is coming up, so got to get that plug in there, right?
Absolutely. I fully endorse that. Was Monday not the most classic Mets day ever? I mean, we'll get into the specifics in a moment, but from 30,000 feet, to me, it was like this was one of the all-time Mets days.
Yeah, I mean, you're sitting there in that press conference, and it's taking a while, so you're figuring, well, this is interesting that it's taking so long. And then when they all come in there with Jeff and Jeff Wilpon and Brody Van Wagenen and Callaway and various assistants, and you think, like, well, what is this going to be? Maybe they're making Mickey a witness to his own execution, or maybe they're going to make Mickey some sort of pitching guru for the organization or something. And then Brody gets up there and says, well, first we're going to start off by saying that Yoenis Cespedes had a violent fall at his ranch, and he broke his ankles, which turned out to be just one broken ankle. But yeah, and then they won't tell us how he did it, and we sort of assume, because it's a ranch, that it's a horse. But so all we really knew yesterday is that he had a violent fall on his ranch, but not off a horse. But we can't say anything more than that. And it's indeterminate, but I don't think we're going to see him for a while.
Yeah,
a long while.
And in that description, Tyler, I thought this was the most classic of that part of the description. Here was part of what Brody said to reporters yesterday in that press conference. Give a listen.
Right now, that's the story from his standpoint and what the information is that we have at this point in time.
Yeah, so you have kids, I have kids. That's what you say. Well, that's his story, and I kept on waiting for him to say, and he's sticking to it, which his wording right there suggests that even he's not completely sure about what happened.
Yeah, I start thinking of, like, Jeff Kent popping wheelies on his motorcycle, and then what was he claimed that he got hurt a different way. I forget how.
You know, like, washing his car, right?
Washing the car, right, yeah. For some reason, I thought of the guy, the Rockies player who was carrying meat or something. Was that
Clint Barmus?
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. So I'm sure the real story will come out soon. I couldn't find it, but I asked someone with the Mets, and I'm like, if he hurt himself in a way that you were okay with, then why wouldn't you just say how he hurt himself? And the person kind of rolled his eyes and just said, well, Brody handled that. So, like, no one was really. So I think there's more to the story. I don't know if they approved of what he was doing. You know, I don't know if it's going to be an Aaron Boone situation. Remember when he tore up his knee famously playing basketball and voided his contract. It's a big contract that he might have risked. So who knows? There's more to be heard. But as far as we know, wasn't off a horse. And that's what we know.
Yeah. And in keeping with the theme, this is so Mets. You know, I think of Mike Puma, the New York Post, was the first one to tweet out yesterday that you know, the Mets are looking into the possible contractual relief and whether or not they'll possibly void the contract. And, of course, the way it was suggested was they're going to look into the contract. Well, no one's going to know the contract better than Brody Van Wagenen, who negotiated it, as Yoenis Cespedes
exactly.
Is his agent. So that was
right.
Classic Mets.
Yeah, the whole thing's so weird and incestuous because Brody was the agent for these guys. You know, he was the agent for Cano, and I asked him about, you know, Cano not hustling over the weekend, but not so much about the hustling. I'm like, well, this guy's not off to a very good start in the first year of your 5-year commitment to him. You know, what has given you reason to think that was still a wise investment, you know, giving up the big prospects? And he sort of went right into agent speak about how he has desire and talent and health, and he has it all in spades, and he's going to be great, and he wants to be great. And it's like, all right, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's, the whole thing's a little, a lot unusual. And then, of course, the kicker is that Cano, after all that not hustling, get benched, kind of getting benched. He was mainly going to be off because of the left-hander. He comes up, he hits a pinch hit double, and he goes home to second faster than he has on a double in 3 years. Anthony DeComo brought that up to Mickey afterwards, and Mickey just kind of laughed and rolled his eyes. He said, "Is that real? Is that right?" And then he sort of said, "Well, you know, I guess he got the hint. You know, you can't make it up."
And I'm going to get to that in a second, but first I want to cover what was supposed to be the headline event of the day was whether or not, as you referenced, whether or not Mickey Callaway was going to be retained as manager, and Brody spoke forcefully about how the old organization is behind them. But again, you have to look at the particular words that are used. We're going to find out very soon how long the phrase foreseeable future actually is, because he didn't commit to Mickey for the rest of the year. He didn't commit to him for a week. We don't know if he's going to last the homestand. We don't know if he's going to last a month. What do you make of all that? Because I feel like, no, they didn't really tell us anything about Mickey Callaway's standing other than using the present tense in the Bill Clinton way. He is the manager.
Yeah, exactly. We tried to pin him down on what foreseeable future meant. He wasn't going there. And it sort of struck me as, look, it's still early in the season and we're just not ready to concede that anything's wrong yet. Because that would be kind of a drastic move to fire the manager 45 games into your tenure. You know, as bad as it's been, they're 21-25. It's not like no team's ever come out of a 21-25 hole. So I just got the feeling they didn't want to, at this point, concede failure, but they just wanted to shut everybody up about the manager and to kind of say, all right, he's our manager, and I don't know that it's going to go away, you know, if they lose 10 in a row or, you know, if they have another really, really bad week, but I think they just wanted to change the conversation, and they weren't ready to concede that things are really bad yet because, look, even if they wanted to start going in a different direction, making trades, they can't. People aren't making trades yet for a couple months or at least a month and a half or so. So stay the course and hope.
And you mentioned Robinson Cano. That whole thing was really funny because, of course, on Sunday, after the second incident in which Robinson Cano didn't run out of ball, Mickey Callaway was not critical of him. In fact, he kind of defended him to reporters on Sunday. But then when he spoke with you guys on Monday, he indicated that part of the reason why, and you were in the room, you can tell me if my perception is wrong, part of the reason why is that he was out of the lineup on Monday was because of the fact that he hadn't run out balls, and he talked about how he and Jim Riggleman, their bench coach, had met with him. But then when you and others went to Cano,
yeah.
Cano didn't take that at all. He basically indicated that that really hadn't come up in his conversation with Riggleman and Callaway. Am I right?
Right, that when they discussed, we told him he was going to have the day off, they didn't say anything about, this is because you didn't run out the balls. They had sort of been planning to have a day off. You know, Mickey had circled Monday as a day off for Cano. He kind of said he should have given him off maybe Sunday just because he had played so many games in a row, but he said, you know what, we'll have him play Sunday, and then we'll give him off Monday because it's against Corbin, who's a good lefty, and, you know. So it was all kind of pre-planned, and when they told Cano that he was going to have this day off, they didn't present it as a disciplinary move. They just told him he was going to have a day off. And so in Cano's mind, he wasn't being disciplined. He was just getting a day off. And he said, you know, I apologized to him already. And, you know, we've moved past that and everything. So Cano's mind, he had addressed it with Mickey already, but this was not a disciplinary move to him. It was
Which
very
is
convenient,
how Mickey's-
though. The timing of it was quite convenient to say that it was disciplinary.
And Mickey, who, as I say, sort of defended Cano on Sunday, presented it sort of as a disciplinary situation in the press conference, yes?
As one of his three reasons, yeah. The others being the lefty and just the fact that he played a lot of time and needed a rest anyway. And
wow.
The reason number two, he said, was the running out the balls and everything. So, yeah, it was very convenient.
I would say this about Brody Van Wagenen in meeting with reporters. I do feel like he absolutely owned his role in the 2019 Mets. When he was asked about his brash statements, he said, "I don't have regrets from this offseason. When I said publicly and privately that I believe that we can create a contending team, I believe that wholeheartedly. I believed in it then, and I believe that there is still enough talent in this room to get back in contention this year." I felt like Brody owned his role in the 2019 team, as he should, Tyler. How did you feel?
I agreed, and I think that it is his his vision. It was the Wilpons' vision. The Wilpons did not want to concede. They wanted to go for it in a way. It's kind of cool with so many teams tanking that the Mets, even though they had 8 out of 10 losing seasons now, they didn't want to tear it down. They didn't have the stomach for that. So they hired a GM who shared that vision and made a lot of moves to that effect. And to Brody's credit, he is going to wear it. And he said to, you know, not, he didn't say blame me because they're not conceding, but he said, this is my responsibility and me and the front office built this team. So I thought that was cool because, you know, to fire Mickey, is Mickey the perfect manager? I don't know. He's made some missteps for sure. But Mickey didn't construct this team and, you know, didn't put all these over 30 guys on it. And, I don't know. I mean, I'm still not sure they're buried yet. I mean, I look, they have four young position players who should be pretty good, you know, with Alonso, Rosario and Conforto and Nimmo, some veterans, some good pitchers. I mean, I think they should be in the mix. But whether they are or not, it's more on the GM than the manager.
Yeah. Brody also said this about the idea of finger pointing. Give a listen to this.
We've experienced a start to the season that none of us are happy with, that none of us are content with. But the finger pointing is not going down the chain of command to the players or the coaches. You know, we built this team in the front office. We believe that this team has the ability to contend the same way we said that in the offseason loudly and proudly. The accountability that will ultimately fall on this team, I want to place on my shoulders. I think that I was the one that put the efforts into helping build this roster. I'll be the one, along with the rest of the front office team, that will continue to make improvements of this roster as we go forward.
So this is where I disagree with Brody on this, and I feel like that if they really want to get away from being the dysfunctional Mets, that they do need to get away from the finger pointing, which goes on. I know about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, word emanated out of that organization in a way that a lot of stuff emanates out of the Mets organization, that Mickey Callaway would be in trouble if they went through a rough stretch. Yes, there was finger pointing going on in that organization. And Tyler, I feel like it's been at the root of a lot of their problems. The finger pointing that goes on, the blame that goes on. Look, I have some pretty good guesses about where the root of that all is. I can't say because I don't know for sure. I don't think it's a coincidence that on Saturday night, every beat writer covering the team quoted a source as saying, well, Mickey's not going to be fired tonight, but we don't know about tomorrow. That type of stuff has to end. And I felt like, and I say having covered George Steinbrenner at the tail end of his heyday, I didn't cover him in the 80s when he was right in the middle of that sort of stuff where he was a source and he was blaming the pitching coach or blaming the manager or blaming a player. That sort of thing is so cancerous and so destructive. And right now, I feel like it's so Mets. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that seems like a pretty good read on it. You know, they're certainly trying to make efforts to get everybody on the same page. I mean, they had a meeting yesterday. They you know, in the clubhouse, Wilpon was there, and Jeff Wilpon was there with Brody and Mickey and the players, and they aired some things out, and they had an internal meeting a week or so ago, you know, with the front office and Mickey to kind of try to get this thing right. You know, you hear, like, the more meetings you have, it's a bad sign, but at least they are trying to be on the same page. And have a unified message and everything. But yeah, I noticed that too when when those reports started coming out immediately, like, hey, he's safe, he's not going to be fired tonight. And that was sort of as far as it went. So it was like, we'll see. I know what you're getting at, and it's a constant sort of swirl of dysfunction there. But Brody is a newcomer to this, and when you get back to it, like. They did, in hiring Brody, they did do something that was quite different. And sometimes different can give you an edge and be helpful. So I give them a little bit of credit for that hire. I don't know if it's going to work or not. But anytime you do something different, you should at least get a little bit of credit for thinking differently and being bold and trying to do something that people hadn't thought of before.
Yeah, and so we'll see if Brody, as he becomes embedded in this job, if he can get a hold of that destructive part of this organization, if he can end that finger pointing, because it has been a major problem for decades. Tyler, thanks for doing this. I always love talking with you.
Yeah, you too, Buster. Thanks a lot.
We'll be back in a moment with Sarah Langs, but first I want to tell you about DXL. Listen up, guys. If you're big or tall, you know what a pain it is to find clothes that fit. So a trip to DXL needs to be on your to-do list. At DXL, big and tall is all they do. They've spent years developing their own sizing patterns to make sure big guys get a comfortable fit every time. Pair that with over 100 brands, and you've got the one-stop shop for men's big and tall. Whether you're looking for jeans, hoodies, suits, or shoes, DXL's got you covered for every occasion in stores or online at DXL.com. DXL, big and tall. Built for you at DXL.com.
Numbers game.
Sarah Langs is a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, normally we talk about the Mets and have a little bit of fun at their expense, but it feels like this is more serious than other times. And I felt like Monday was the most Mets day ever. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's so hard. Media perception with that team is so negative sometimes. And then things like this happen. It's so unbelievable. And it really feels like one of those things where you really can't see this happening to other teams, right? But it was so, just on a personal level, like the idea that this guy is rehabbing, Yoenis Cespedes obviously rehabbing from surgery on both of his heels, and he gets these ankle fractures. We don't know exactly how. We were told it wasn't on a horse, but we don't know, I think would be the proper way to put that. But God, that's just so demoralizing, you know? I mean, on a personal level, about a player who we've seen struggle a lot and is such an exciting player when he's healthy, but it's been so long now.
Sarah, you're about my age. Did you ever play Mad Libs when you were a kid?
Oh, yes, I did.
So yeah, this story, it seems like a Mad Libs story. Like, Yoenis Cespedes fractures both ankles while on a horse. Like, it doesn't seem real.
That is the best analysis I've heard so far of this.
Yeah, that's a great one. As we were talking about with Tyler Kepner, you don't even know exactly what to take at face value. Even Brody Van Wagenen yesterday said, well, that's his story. And if he had said, and he's sticking to it, it would have been absolutely perfect. I'd say this, just in a pure, just looking at it through pure analysis, I heard that, you know, his surgery last year was so complicated on those heels that there was a chance at that time that he was never going to come back and be the same player. But now you look at it. They haven't ruled out this year officially, but of course it doesn't look like he's going to play this year. He's going to be 34 years old. When he comes back next spring, if he tries to come back, it'll be 21 months since he last played in the big leagues. I feel like we may have seen the last of Yoenis Cespedes as an effective major league player. Is that reasonable speculation?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the first things I thought. You know, I mean, I'm concerned he won't play again. I don't have any real basis for that other than the fact that we know how involved the surgery was. We know how long it took Troy Tulowitzki to come back. And by the way, he got hurt again very soon after. And that it just seems like, you know, it just doesn't feel like you can come back from it too easily. And definitely it's hard to imagine him, you know, racing in a second on a double, right? I mean, hopefully he could have that power, hit some balls over the wall, hit some home runs, but it's just so hard to know. And that's so long to be away from the team and so long to end up deconditioned. Even if someone does stay in shape, you know, these guys do try to stay in shape when they're out for injury like that. It's tough. You know, I'm really concerned we've seen the last of the electric, you know, Yoenis Cespedes.
Yeah, especially somebody that big. Like, to me, if he's going to come back and be an effective player, he would have to lose like 40 pounds. All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three
is 15. So speaking of things that have gone well for the Mets of late and this year, Pete Alonso hit his 15th career home run last night and his 15th of the season, of course, in the Mets game against the Nationals. That's already tied with Ron Swoboda in 1965 for the most first half home runs by any Mets rookie. And it's only May. You know, Shea Stadium was harder to hit home runs in, maybe, or, you know, not everybody is up with the team at the beginning of the year, but the stat stands regardless. So if you're curious about the Mets' rookie record for home runs, that would be 26 by Daryl Strawberry in 1983. No other Mets rookie has even hit 20 home runs in a season. There are a bunch of deserving candidates in the National League for Rookie of the Year. We're going to get to two more of them in a second. But the only Mets position player to win Rookie of the Year, that would be Strawberry in that 1983 season. The last Met to win Rookie of the Year, of course, was Jacob deGrom in 2014.
Number two
is 10. So speaking of those Rookie of the Year candidates, 10 is the number of starts in Mike Soroka's career where he's allowed one or fewer earned runs. He's only made 12 starts. That's the most starts of one earned run or fewer in a player's first 12 career games since earned runs became official in 1913. Wow. Nobody else has done that. And this guy, he was electric last year, and he ended up missing most of the season with a right shoulder strain. I was at his first major league game. It was a lot of fun. His family was there with these big Canadian flags, and he pitched great. Pitched six innings, gave up one run. It was the day before my birthday, by the way. Anyway, he's back. He's still Rookie of the Year eligible, and he's been outstanding this year. We'll get to one more pitcher Rookie of the Year candidate in a second. But this guy's just been so good. He has a 159 opponent's average, 101 ERA, 087 whip. The only Braves pitcher to win Rookie of the Year was Craig Kimbrel in 2011. And the last overall was, of course, Acuna last year. And Soroka's not on your leaderboards yet. If you're going to go on your phone and check for all the stats, he's like four innings shy of qualifying. But in his next start, if he, you know, pitches five, six innings, he'll be on there.
Number one
is 156. So I told you we had one more NL Rookie of the Year candidate to talk about. And 156 is Chris Paddock's opponent batting average this season, in his first season in the bigs. The lowest opponent average for any rookie in a qualified season for the whole year is 182 by Jose Fernandez in 2013 and Hideo Nomo in 1995. Wow. Obviously, it's only May. Paddock has a way to go, but he's way outpacing that. And both of those guys, Fernandez in 2013 and Nomo in 1995, won Rookie of the Year honors. And this applies to both Soroka and Paddock right now, honestly, with the way they're pitching. But I want to make sure we're all aware. The only player to win Cy Young and Rookie of the Year in the same season was Fernando Valenzuela in 1981. The only Padres pitcher to win Rookie of the Year was Butch Metzger in 1976 when he shared the award with Pat Zachary. And the last Padre to win overall was Benito Santiago in 1987. And I think it's so funny because entering this year, there was some hype around Paddock, but we all thought Fernando Tatis Jr. is going to be the Padres Rookie of the Year winner. Just, you know, pencil it in. It's ready to go. A lot of people had that. And here we have someone else on that team who's in a great position.
Yeah. And now he's over 50 innings. We talked about it. You wonder if the Padres at some point are going to have some really tough decisions about his innings limits. Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
We'll be back in a moment with Tim Kirchen, but first I want to tell you about Valspar. Are you staining your deck this summer again? This time, maybe you should try something that's stain-changing. Valspar Solid Color Stain. It's easy to apply, all-weather protection that brings so much color and coverage to the party, you can bring out the color of the shutters or the planters or even your eyes. You'll love it, guaranteed, for 10 years. Yeah, that's stain-changing. Valspar Exterior Stain, only at Lowe's.
Scene heads rejoice.
Nerd alert!
It's Timmy time.
Is this a great game or what?
With Tim Kirchen on Baseball Tonight.
And Tim Kirchen covers baseball for ESPN. And Tim, you're always our go-to guy when it comes to history questions. And we got a great Bleacher tweet from Kyle Benning, who asked the question, building on last Friday's Bleacher tweet, as well as the current Twitter poll on Yadier Molina's Hall of Fame candidacy, can you rank these catchers in order of the most Hall of Fame worthy? So, Tim, rank in order for Hall of Fame worthiness, Joe Mauer, Yadier Molina, Jorge Posada, Buster Posey.
Oh, God. This is the first question I get out of the box. What are you doing?
Good morning, Tim.
God. Yeah. All right. This is impossible. I'm going to say Molina is going to be first eventually. Not at the moment, but he will be the first of those four to go in. Posey second, Mauer third, Posada fourth. So that's how okay. I would rank them as far as where I think when they're done, they're going to be. Molina first, Posey second, Mauer third, Posada fourth.
Okay, so I think that when Molina hits 2,000 hits, he's got about 100 more to go. For me, that's pretty much going to clinch the deal. Just knowing how writers are and how they sort of view these things and benchmarks, I feel like 2,000 hits is a big benchmark for him, Tim. What do you think?
Yeah, he just doesn't have enough offense at the exact moment now to say, yes, he's a Hall of Famer. Everything else, of course, points that way. And he's still a productive offensive player now. In fact, there are days I think this is the best I've seen him swing the bat in a while. And that's what he needs is just a few more. You got to get to these big numbers if you're going to get in. And even though his numbers are everywhere offensively, I mean defensively, 2,000 hits would probably do it for him. Yes.
So just hearing you sort of puzzle over that particular question, I just want to let you know I thought of an idea this morning when I was taking the dog on a walk this morning. I thought about coming up with a list of, like, the top 15 third basemen, basically come up with 15 names at each position currently in baseball, and then present to you one position a week. Tim, break down the top 10 players at this position. What do you think?
Yeah, that's really great, Buster. Let's do that at 8 o'clock in the morning when I've got 600 other things on my mind. Let's pick the 15 best players at each position in order. Let's be really fair about that.
Yeah, I didn't think you'd be too thrilled about that. Fans in Toronto, not too thrilled that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was not in the lineup on Monday. The Blue Jays are playing a 1 o'clock game against the Red Sox. At the Rogers Center because it was a national holiday in Canada. And Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who had just been named the American League Player of the Week because he had four home runs last week and he started doing the things we all expect him to do for the next 15 years or so, not in the lineup. And Charlie Montoya, the manager, explained to reporters, look, we need to work in off days for him. He'd played 16 straight days. He had an injury in spring training. This is what was scheduled. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., also mentioned to reporters that, yes, in spring training, he, of course, had had, you know, the abdominal injury, and he understands why the Blue Jays are doing this. Tim, I suspect, because you know this is not just a manager's decision, this is an organization decision, that if you were to give truth serum to Ross Atkins, their general manager, Mark Shapiro, the club president today, they probably would say, you know what, we didn't put as much thought into that as maybe we should have. Arrange a schedule to make sure he plays on that day. What do you think?
Buster, Vlad Guerrero is a national holiday in Toronto. That's how important he is to where that club is going, to the people who come watch that team play. Yeah, look, I'm all for giving players rest in this day and age, even 20-year-olds who are swinging it really well. I get it, but you have to be a little more judicious about what day do you give him off. When you're playing an afternoon game on a Monday on a holiday in Canada, the guy everyone wants to see has to be in the lineup. So you go to him and say, Vlad, sorry, we forgot. We were going to give you Monday off, but now we're going to give you Tuesday off instead. It's that simple. That's what I think they should have done, and I think in hindsight that's what they would have done if they could do it again.
Yep, 100%. Look, over the course of baseball season, you'll back me up on this, Tim. There are times when it kind of becomes Groundhog Day, right, where the manager, you know, the players, if you ask them, hey, where are you guys going to be in 3 days, they don't know because it's just relentless with the day after day after day. And I think that times, you know, they're looking at it at ground level rather than from 30,000 feet. What do you think?
Yeah, well, again, Buster, most of our managers now have planned their lineups like a week in advance. You know, J.D. Martinez is getting Wednesday off. And unless he wants Thursday off, but this is what I've got planned. And I totally get it, but you have to look every day and see how somebody's playing or how the team's playing, and then might change your plan. Our players need to know whether they're going to play or not, but ultimately they're players. They should do what they're told. And if they get an off day or they're told you don't get an off day, just go out and do the best we can.
So I saw that this number last night, set of numbers on Cody Bellinger, and you were the first person I thought of because I know you love numbers like these. Think about this, Tim. When we talk about Cody Bellinger improving as a hitter. Cody Bellinger in 2019, when hitting in full counts this year, 12 for 20, 11 walks, 4 strikeouts. 12 for 20, 11 walks, 4 strikeouts. He's batting 600 in full counts, 742 on base percentage, 950 slugging percentage. I think that's an indication that he's figured some things out.
Yeah, he's figured so much out, Buster. And first off, he's got a beautiful swing to start with. So we're starting at a perfect spot for him. Now he's figuring out how that swing works. He's figuring out what they're trying to do to him, and he's got a plan every single night. I didn't think there was such a thing as a hitter's plan years ago, and now with the way we adjust things, the way our hitting coaches are all over this stuff, there is a real plan in place. And, you know, there used to be a day also, Buster, where you're going to see a fastball on 3-2. Well, those days don't exist anymore either, which is really impressive for a guy to be hitting that kind of, with those kind of numbers on that count, knowing I'm not getting a fastball here necessarily. I'll probably get something off speed here on a 3-2 count. So there used to be a day where you'd look at that number and say, wow, that's impressive, but he knows a heater's coming there. And we don't know that anymore, which makes what Cody Bellinger is doing on so many levels really, really impressive.
Gleyber Torres against the Orioles this year, these numbers after last night's game, he's 17 for 35, 3 doubles, 8 homers, 4 walks, is hitting .486 with a slugging percentage of .1257. The Yankees come back to beat the Orioles last night. And look, I know the Orioles are not good. They're not going to be good for a long time. But I think we can say unequivocally now, the Yankees have survived these early season injuries. What do you think?
Right. And Gleyber Torres has been like the one constant. Everyone else has been hurt or slumping, and he's been great. He's got 5 multi-homer games already, Buster, in his career. He's 22 years old. And what he's done to the Orioles, he's hit over 4 straight games against the Orioles. I mean, they have survived in part because he's been so good, and not just at one position, but at 2 if they needed him, which they did briefly. That's why the Yankees are where they are, is that the bench has been so great, but the few guys who haven't been hurt, like Gleyber Torres, have kept them afloat to be one game ahead in their division at this point. I don't care what kind of schedule they played, is miraculous, and Torres is right in the middle of that.
So you are in Chicago tonight. You're going to be broadcasting the game between the Phillies and the Cubs. Last night in Wrigley Field, Jake Arrieta got a great response from Cubs fans. This is what it sounded like at Wrigley Field.
Some folks standing up for Jake. Wow, look at Darvish. He walked back behind the mound. This is nice.
Yeah, so that was Tom McCarthy, NBC Sports Philadelphia, describing that moment, the big cheer. Jake took his batting helmet off. He waved it to the crowd. I love the fact, Tim, that Yu Darvish stepped away from the rubber to give him an opportunity to have that moment.
Right. It was tremendous. And Darvish had said the day before, talking about Arrieta, he said, look, he's a legend in this town, and we all need to respect that, basically. And then he showed it last night, which was so impressive. And just another reminder how good Cub fans can be, and they waited so long, and Jake Arrieta had so much to do with them winning a World Series. He had so much to do with elevating that team, and we can't forget, Buster, that Cy Young season and then half of the next season, just how brilliant that guy was. And he's never lost sight of the fact that he loves Chicago, he loves that ballpark, he doesn't mind telling people that. Still, even though he's on another team, and I think that's all healthy, and that's the way it should be. Plus, every Cub fan in there knows Jake Arrieta tries, works, like almost no pitcher we've ever seen as far as getting his body in shape and getting ready to compete.
So here's my theory before we move on to the Angels and how luckless they've been. When it comes to the Cubs and the 2016 team that won the World Series, I think they're going to be 2 statues. They're going to come off that team. One is going to be Joe Maddon. At some point, you're going to have a statue of Joe Maddon around Wrigley Field. And the other one, I think, is going to be Anthony Rizzo at the moment he caught the ball and the Cubs win the World Series and his arms are outstretched. What do you think?
Yeah, that's the perfect one. And as he's running, you should see they should have the ball in his back pocket because it's amazing to me that through all of that, he thought, I'm going to put this in my pocket so I don't lose it, because this is history in the making. So it's the perfect, as Bryant is running towards him and he's running towards Bryant, these great corner guys who had everything to do with that last out. Let's see Anthony Rizzo racing in, you're right, in a monument, in a statue with a baseball in his back pocket. That would be perfect for me.
And if Chris Bryant stays with the Cubs, maybe he gets a statue, and the look would have to be as he throws the ball. You remember he had that grin on his face. Which is, he told reporters he didn't know that he was smiling, but he was just beaming as he threw that ball.
Yeah, I'm not sure he was necessarily smiling yet. I think that was a look of, please get to first base safely here, and we're going to win the World Series. That was an epic look on his face, and what a finish that was.
So I mentioned the Angels being luckless. Last night in the eighth inning, they lost players on consecutive at-bats. Shohei Ohtani was hit by a pitch on his right ring finger. The x-rays were negative. We'll get more information on that today. The Angels are more concerned about what happened with Andrelton Simmons. Give a listen, Tim.
Chopper to the right side. Astudillo feeds Rogers, and not an easy play. Simba goes down, and he may have hurt himself.
One of those extremely tough plays as you're trying to beat that one out. He looks like he hurt his leg.
Yeah, rolled an ankle badly, Tim. That from Angels Television. They got x-rays. They didn't find any fractures, but he sprained the ankle. They're going to get more information later today. I've gotten to the point with those type of injury, Tim, I don't even like looking at it. Like when I see a headline on a basketball player, you know, suffers a leg injury, I don't even want to see it. And I felt the same way with that play last night about Simmons, in part because you just hate looking at somebody in agony. But the other thing, too, is you're just heartbroken for the guy.
Right. He's such a good player. And you're right, Buster. Whenever I hear he rolled an ankle, I refuse to watch it under any circumstances, because on my tiny little level, I've done that a couple times. The pain is immeasurable. It's so bad. And if you roll it badly enough, Buster, you're going to be out a month. If it's black and blue all the way around that ankle, it's going to be a while before he's able to play. Now, I hope it's not that bad for him, but he's also such a good guy, Buster. I was at the Orioles the other day when the Angels were in, and Andrelton Simmons walked by me heading towards the batting cage. And I just casually said, how you doing? He said, good, just trying to figure out that hitting thing again. That hitting thing is what he called it. It was beautiful, and every hitter in the big leagues knows exactly what he's talking about, even though he was hitting 291 at the time and had done some pretty good things. He called it that hitting thing. He has to go figure it out again in the cage because he lost it for a moment. That's how hard hitting is. That's how much that guy cares. And now it appears the Angels are going to be out without him for a while, and that's a huge loss for them as they started to make a little move in the standings.
And before we go, I want to give you some advice that probably comes too late. I don't know if you noticed this or heard about this, Tim, but I'm the reigning champion of the president's race because a likeness of me wound up winning a relay in the president's race. And, of course, I thought of you and when you ran in the sausage race in Milwaukee. Just a piece of advice. If you get that offer again, let somebody else run the race in a costume with your name on it, Tim.
Yeah, first off, Buster, I'm well aware that your head won the race. Okay, and you don't have to remind me, I will never get in one of those costumes again. I've told you this story, but when I first tried on the hot dog costume, the guy who was running the thing told me, you know, this is built for big people to run in these, and you're not very big. That's what he told me. Like, there was no doubt about that. So I run the worst race ever, and I don't know if you know this part. I walked in the clubhouse after the game as a reporter now because I covered the game. Kyle Loesch announces to the entire Brewers clubhouse, there he is, the worst hot dog racer of all time. That's how I get announced when I walk into the clubhouse. And then I go to the truck afterwards to, you know, to say hi to everyone after the game, and we're having a post-game meal, and we're having sausage from the sausage race. It was the stupidest night of my entire life. I hope it never happens again.
Yeah, and I had the greatest night of my life because I won the president's race, Tim. That's how it goes down in the record books, right? I won. It was awesome.
You should be so proud, Buster, really.
Bleacher Tweets.
Clearing out the rest of the Bleacher Tweets, Buster. We begin with this one from Michael Preston at MickP1979. Michael says, as the Yankees now hold first place in the American League East, if they're healthy by the All-Star break, is there any way they should not be the World Series favorites given their star lineup and rotation? The fact that it should be the freshest in the majors.
Michael, it's a fair perspective. And you're wrong. The Houston Astros are the World Series favorites right now. They are an absolute steamroller. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, as the Yankees get some of their guys back, like is Didi Gregorius going to stay healthy? As Giancarlo Stanton comes back, is he really, truly healthy? You know, Aaron Judge, we heard from Carlos Beltran recently that he thinks that Aaron Judge is going to be battling this injury all year. So it will be interesting. Plus, I do think that before the trade deadline, you're going to see both the Astros and the Yankees, as well as teams like the Red Sox, make additions. So the team's going to look a little bit different. You agree with me, Josh?
No, I definitely agree with you. But I'm just thinking, if things shake out the way that it looks like they will now, and we're not even to Memorial Day yet, but can you imagine an Astros-Yankees ALCS? All kidding aside, that would be really fun. That would be a great matchup.
Well, Red Sox-Astros would be fantastic.
We saw that last year,
though. Fantastic. Yeah, but look, the Astros are in a different place. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they're healthier. I think they're a better team than they were last year. And let's not forget Rena Benin's Minnesota Twins.
That's true.
Who are merely killing the ball better than any other team, putting the ball in the air. And can you imagine if they go out and make a trade for like a Bumgarner before the deadline?
Sure.
Add to that rotation, that will be a really interesting team. Meanwhile, you and I are just dismissing the Rays at this point.
I know. I had him ranked number one in my Power 10 for so long, and now I don't even mention him. Go figure. L.A. Bum is next. At Dat L.A. Bum says, hey guys, since most sports writers embrace analytics, shouldn't there just be an agreed-upon war formula that determines the MVP, Cy Young, Rookie of the Year, etc.?
So what you're suggesting, Datla Bum, is that the writers
Dat
come
LA
up with a
Bum,
formula.
Buster.
Okay. Well, I just... I
like Los Angeles.
Together. Come on.
All right.
I know. Come on. So what you're basically suggesting is that the writers would adopt a formula that would take the writers in a writer's award out of the equation.
Yes.
That ain't happening. The other thing too, and I think you'll agree with me on this, the Mariano Rivera Hall of Fame candidacy was the only thing that writers ever agreed to, ever.
Right. Right. Buster, what's it say on the Dodgers caps?
Dude, just move along with that, okay?
Christopher Shields at Christy_Shields. If you were the president of baseball operations for a new expansion team, who would you appoint as skipper from the current crop of free agent managers, guys like Buck Showalter, Joe Girardi, or maybe there's a rookie out there who hasn't gotten a shot yet that you'd like to give an opportunity to?
It's interesting. I had this conversation recently with Matt Wieters, who used to play for Buck Showalter, and we both agree that, I mean, Showalter's had an amazing career as a manager. But you could see him being part of a leadership group for baseball ops. And that's not to say Joe Girardi, you know, couldn't do that sort of job. But Buck Showalter has done that with organizations repeatedly. Like from the ground up, he helped to build the Diamondbacks. Mm-hmm. He's been an important, that's part of his resume.
Yeah. No, you're not going to get me to say anything different.
Didn't make me Johnny Super Scout.
Give me Johnny Super Scout, right. And I like my chances. Brett Caro, finally. Love this question. At Caro Brett. If you had to have one announcer call a pivotal play all time, who would it be?
It has to be Vin Scully, because you think about all the great calls he's already had.
One ball and no strikes. Aaron waiting. The outfield deep and straight away. Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone. Marvelous moment for baseball. What a marvelous moment for Atlanta and the state of Georgia. What a marvelous moment for the country and the world. A black man is getting a standing ovation in the Deep South for breaking a record of an all-time baseball idol. And it is a great moment for all of us, and particularly for Henry Aaron.
So the winning run is at second base with two out. 2 to Mookie Wilson. Little roller up along first. Behind the band. It gets through Buckner. Here comes Knight, and the Mets win it. High fly ball into right field. She is gone. In a year that has been so improbable, the impossible has happened.
Yeah, so Brett, it has to be Vin Scully in my mind. Josh, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's sacrilege to argue for anybody other than Vin Scully. Throw a couple other names in there, you know, Buck, obviously, Euchre, perhaps. But there's one guy who I really think would do a phenomenal job with any pivotal moment. Buster, do you know where I'm leaning?
Well, you could go in one of two directions, mm-hmm. but go ahead.
This is a play from this season. April 11th.
Now the 3-1 pitch. A swing and a drive. Deep right field. Away, way back, way out of here. Gone for Martin. That's Jim Thome territory. Near the back of the lower deck in right. 2-0 Indians.
That's a Leonis. Yeah, that's a Leonis Martin home run from April 11th, 2019, Buster. If you get that kind of enthusiasm from a Leonis Martin home run in the middle of April, imagine what you'd get for something that actually really left a stamp on the history of the game.
Yeah, you and I have talked about that. Tom Hamilton, the Indians play-by-play man on radio. What it would sound like if the Indians won the World Series for the first time since 1948, and Tom Hamilton's voice at the moment that that happened.
Yeah.
I bet you he's got something in mind.
I bet he does.
He's such a big baseball fan.
Yeah.
He's certainly going into Game 7 in 2016. He had an opportunity to think about that. But I also wondered if you were going to go in the direction of Ted Leitner, given our recent conversation.
I know, given the fact that
he's your guy.
I knew you thought that's where I would go, but I threw you a little curveball. But yeah, I mean, like I said about Tom Hamilton, I think if the Indians had actually won Game 7 in 2016, and let's say the circumstances were different and they walked it off, I think Tom's head would have actually exploded, and he wouldn't have wanted it any other way.
Well, and you and I know that if the Padres would have won the World Series, Ted Leitner would work the phrase, my Padres, into it someplace.
That's right.
Right?
He says, my Padres when things are good, your Padres when things are going bad. Things couldn't be any better if the Padres won the World Series, so he would definitely drop a my Padres in there.
Yeah, 100%. By the way, we got a lot of nice response to that interview with Ted last week, so we appreciate that. That's it for today. My thanks to Tyler Kepner, to Tim Kirchin, to Sarah Langs, to Josh Macri, who produces this podcast every day. One more thing. The Emmys were announced on Monday night, and Sunday Night Baseball did well again. The team from Disney Technology, formerly ESPN Technology, led by Christian Kokas, Jeff Bradshaw, Brian Rooney, Steve Bernstein, and their bosses, Phil Orleans, Tom Archer, won an Emmy for great sound on Sunday Night Baseball. We've gone back-to-back in that category because of our use of the front row cam last year. So, Josh, we got a little dynasty going with Sunday Night Baseball and the tech folks.
Absolutely, yeah. And all kidding aside, all seriousness, congratulations to everybody involved. That's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, absolutely great. I can't wait to see those guys on Sunday. Give them a high five. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.